21-9582 Alghizi v. Garland. And you're Ms. Casey?
I am Ms. Casey.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees non-citizens the right to effective assistance of counsel in immigration removal proceedings.
Could you put the mic directly in front of you?
Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Certainly. The Due Process Clause guarantees non-citizens the right to effective assistance of counsel in immigration removal proceedings in order to ensure that those proceedings are fundamentally fair. Mr. Alghizi was deprived of this fundamental right when his prior counsel, Ms. Cynthia Gordon, now disbarred before both the state of Utah and the Board of Immigration Appeals, failed to provide effective assistance of counsel in his application for the non-discretionary form of relief of refugee adjustment of status under 1159A. Because of this, we ask that this court grant Mr. Alghizi's petition and remand the case back to the Board of Immigration Appeals in order for the agency to properly consider his application for this non-discretionary form of relief.
Didn't he have to include in his motion to reopen the grounds, let's say prejudice for the ineffective assistance of counsel, how it would have made a difference, what he could have alleged that would have beaten the trick bar? I don't see that in there.
Well, Your Honor, the ineffective assistance by Ms. Gordon pervades the entire record. And specifically, her waiver of his right to appeal not only, of course, foreclosed his ability to challenge the judge's adverse decision, but also led to the unclear decision of the immigration judge. The judge, because she waived his right to appeal, the judge did not have to enter a written order, nor did the judge enter a clear oral decision articulating the basis for his grounds of denial. Therefore, when Mr. Alghizi submitted his motion to reopen, he met the requirements. He submitted an application for adjustment of status under 1159A, answered the questions regarding whether the material support bar applied in the negative, and this should be sufficient because he wasn't provided with a clear articulation by the judge.
What if we conclude that in his motion to reopen, he didn't assert facts that would qualify as prejudice from deficient performance of counsel? Is that the end of that? He had to do that, didn't he?
He certainly had to assert that he was prejudiced by the ineffective assistance.
And explain why and how, what his counsel could have introduced as far as evidence that would have resulted in a change of outcome.
First and foremost, Ms. Gordon could have and should have objected to the highly prejudicial evidence submitted by the Department of Homeland Security related to the material support bar. She failed to object on authentication grounds.
Well, failure to object is a little different, I think, from where Judge Phillips is headed. I think she has to come back with facts. If you're going to show prejudice, you have to say, this is what should have been presented and wasn't. And do we have that here? I mean, we have the facts. In fact, out of his own mouth, it sounds like he pretty much admitted to the Trigg violation. And that's what the initial IJ relied on. So don't you have to come back with facts to say, no, the facts are wrong or something is wrong?
I would disagree, Your Honor, with the premise that he admitted to a Trigg violation.
How about this? He admitted to facts that the IJ concluded were Trigg violations.
I would also disagree with this premise because the IJ did not conclude that they were Trigg violations. There is no clear decision from the immigration judge. The immigration judge states that he was denying relief because Mr. Alghizi failed to meet his burden. Period. The immigration judge went back and forth through the record about whether he thought Mr. Alghizi had met his burden, could have participated, didn't participate, was credible, was not credible.
Well, didn't the IJ, the initial IJ, determine that he was not credible?
That is also a contested issue. Certainly the Department of Homeland Security Council encouraged the judge to find Mr. Alghizi not credible, and that is annotated on the final order, written by the Department of Homeland Security Council, not the immigration judge. But more than that, even assuming that
was counsel told to make that entry on the order by the immigration judge?
The immigration judge acquiesced, yes, and the counsel did write it on the order. But the judge failed to provide any type of clear and cogent rationale for the adverse credibility finding, which is required by BIA precedent. So the adverse credibility finding cannot stand. It is not supported by BIA precedent. Nor do we have a clear decision from the immigration judge as to what exactly Mr. Alghizi needed to find on his motion to reopen. Excuse me, Mr. Alghizi needed to present with his motion to reopen in order to establish a reasonable likelihood that he would have avoided deportation had he had been provided with effective assistance of counsel below. And that is the standard before the Tenth Circuit standard. It's not that the prior counsel would have submitted specific evidence, but it's rather, had she done her job appropriately and effectively, is there a reasonable likelihood that he would have avoided deportation? And the answer to that question is yes, there is a reasonable likelihood. Mr. Alghizi, this is a non-discretionary form of relief. And assuming that he is admissible, this relief should have and could have been granted. In addition to this, the board abused its discretion in denying Mr. Alghizi's motion to reopen based on changed country conditions. While I think the stronger argument is related to ineffective assistance of counsel and prejudice to Mr. Alghizi, he also asserted a changed country conditions in order to justify reopening of his proceedings.
Isn't there also an untimeliness problem here? 5 years untimely?
Well, for changed country conditions, no. There, those
reopening.
There, yes, absolutely.
And isn't that a problem?
No, it's not a problem, Your Honor.
5 years is okay.
It certainly is okay because
you're smiling.
the motion to reopen, the debt filing deadline can be told in where there is an ineffective assistance of counsel, as long as the Mr. Alghizi exercised due diligence. Now, I would say he exercised due diligence when he filed an appeal of the immigration judge's decision just 15 days after the judge entered his decision and after Ms. Worden had waived his right to appeal without his consent and understanding. That certainly is due diligence. The board then rejected his appeal, telling him that he could not file it because the right had been waived. Shortly thereafter, he was released from immigration custody, given a work card, and told to go about his life. Then, because of a policy change with the presidential administration, not because of any negative act for Mr. Alghizi, he was picked up in 2017, and his removal order, the government began steps to effectuate his removal order. Immediately upon that,
But he takes no action between 2013 and 2017, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. The immigration judge below expressly declined to address the issue of equitable tolling. The second immigration judge indicated that because he found that the immigration judge number one's decision was clear and Mr. Alghizi had not established prejudice, they did not need to reach the issue of tolling. So should this court believe that consideration of this issue is necessary or remand to the board for...
There was witnesses on the changed country condition and, you know, anti-Christian bias, experts on both sides, it looks like. Aren't we bound by substantial evidence in the record to support the board's decision that the country conditions had not changed substantially since 2012?
Your Honor, I agree that there was evidence on both sides, but the decision from both the IJ and the BIA failed to consider, or maybe better said, misconstrued some of the evidence that was provided by Mr. Alghizi, specifically around changed country conditions in Iraq in 2018 regarding the Iraqi government's treatment of deportees from the United States. Because the context, of course, is that the Trump administration had, in an agreement, had issued the Muslim ban, the so-called Muslim ban, and Iraq didn't like it, and asked to be removed from the list of prohibited countries. And in exchange, they agreed to start taking deportees repatriated from the United States. And with that was a lot of publicity around the fact that these deportees that Iraq was taking back had criminal histories and significant criminal histories. And therefore, there was an increased likelihood and there was a change in the conditions in Iraq for these deportees. Now, in denying the motion based on changed country conditions, immigration judge Greer, immigration judge number two, and then the BIA simply said, well, he had a criminal record in 2012 and he still had a criminal record in 2018, so nothing had particularly changed. But this ignores the fact that in 2012 we weren't deporting people to Iraq, and in 2018 there was a significantly heightened negative inference about individuals coming back, and therefore...
What was his crime again?
His crime, which is not relevant to his eligibility for relief, was a battery, a domestic violence battery crime in 2008, I believe. The reason that he was ordered deported, of course, was because the immigration judge simply found he wasn't eligible for the non-discretionary relief of adjustment of status. He was not deported on any criminal grounds. However, in Iraq, that he might be perceived differently.
And he has family that still has remained in Iraq?
There are family in Iraq, extended family, yes, that he hasn't seen in 30 years that remain in Iraq.
Kind of the anti-Christian bias, is that a countrywide, what's the record show? Is that a countrywide phenomenon or is it more geographically specific? And if it's the latter, how would you characterize where his family has remained? Which I understand is southern Iraq.
Your Honor, I'm honestly not prepared to answer that question in detail. I think the record shows that with the rise of ISIS, there certainly is an increased likelihood in the persecution of Christians, and it is regional in Iraq.
Okay.
And if I may, I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
You may, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's hear from Attorney General Garland. Ms. Hennis?
May it please the court, Stephanie Hennis for respondent. In this case, Your Honors, the issue isn't whether the petitioner experienced ineffective assistance from his prior counsel. The issue, and the only issue that the immigration judge and the board considered when denying the petitioner's motion to reopen based on ineffective assistance, was that he failed to establish prejudice. And prejudice in this court requires a reasonable likelihood that but for the ineffective assistance, the petitioner would have obtained the relief that he sought. Now, here, as Your Honors pointed out before, there's already evidence in the record showing that the petitioner engaged in material support of terrorism. He admitted at pages 986 and 987 of the record that he provided food to fighters during the Iraqi uprising, that they were armed with rocket-propelled grenades and machine guns. At the time, he knew that what they were doing with their weapons, which was attacking government officials. He also knew that protesters with machine guns were capturing cars and government buildings. There's really no question that that falls within the statutory definition of material support of terrorism.
And is that what the first IJ decided?
Yes, Your Honor. So, well, two things. One, the government maintains that the court doesn't need to determine that the first immigration judge made that finding. In order to secure reopening, a person needs to show a prima facie case for relief. And given that there's evidence in this case that the material support bar applied and the petitioner did not come forward with any new evidence to explain why that evidence was incorrect.
But again, the first IJ said it applied.
Yes.
And the first IJ also, correct me if I'm wrong, determined that the petitioner was not credible?
Yes. So if you If you look at page 1032 of the record, that is when the first immigration judge gives a short summary of the reasons for denial. The immigration judge says that he is adopting the DHS brief and analysis on the material support bar. That's at 1032 and 1033, and the DHS brief is at 1169 to 1175. And in that briefing is where DHS laid out precisely what I'm describing now. As to the adverse credibility finding, I know the petitioner has taken the position that there wasn't an adverse credibility finding. However, if the court looks at 1017 to 1018 of the record, the immigration judge requests arguments about the differing accounts of what the petitioner did during the uprising, because in his refugee application, which he signed attesting to the truth of the application, he said that he was armed, that he guarded an area, and that he engaged in intifada. In 2004, in response to a request for evidence, he stepped back from all of that and said that he only helped provide food and comfort to the protesters. He claims that he didn't remember providing that letter, but he did attest to the fact that he signed it.
Well, would humanitarian aid, is that enough to satisfy the TRIG exception?
Well, so this isn't humanitarian aid. This does fall within the definition of material support, particularly where he decides to provide food to those who are fighting, the people who have machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades. The board and...
So you could provide a sandwich as long as the person you give the sandwich to does not have an AK-47 or something.
As long as they
don't have a weapon.
The question is whether the person who is providing the support has reasonable knowledge or should reasonably be aware of the fact that the person he's supporting is engaging or about likely to engage in terrorist activity. So that is what was... that is what he testified to in court here.
Can you speak to Secretary Napolitano's exemption for the Iraqi uprising and why that doesn't fit?
Sure. So a couple of preliminary issues here. The Secretary's authority to, in her sole discretion, to provide an exemption is a discretionary determination that where jurisdiction is significantly restricted. The statute requires that the court's review be limited to a determination on an exemption and that it be in a petition for review and that the court only review legal and constitutional claims. We would argue here that there's no jurisdiction because there is no determination as to an exemption. And the reason that there's no determination as to an exemption here is because the Secretary and then DHS laid out threshold requirements for determining whether a person would in fact be considered for this discretionary determination. And one of those is that the person has to fully disclose all of the involvement that the person, all of the material support that the person provided in their various interviews and filings with the government. And given the adverse credibility finding in this case, the adverse credibility finding went directly to the fact that the petitioner provided varying stories about his involvement in the uprising. There was no referral made for a determination on this. If the court is interested in learning a little bit more about how the process works, I can give that to you. However, the petitioner hasn't raised any challenge to the process that's used to refer cases for exemptions.
And didn't raise that in the motion to reopen, right?
No, Your Honor. Since we are talking about exemptions, I do want to address the argument that the petitioner made in her reply brief The respondent argued in our brief that there's no liberty interest in an exemption, and because there's no liberty interest in an exemption, it can't support an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Petitioner argued that three cases from the Seventh Circuit supported the notion that there's a liberty interest in his non-discretionary adjustment of status. The government recognizes that non-discretionary refugee adjustment would present a liberty interest, but because of the material support bar in this case, it's not adjustment that the petitioner seeks. It's a discretionary waiver, a discretionary exemption that functions like a pardon. So the cases that she cited discussed people who sought to apply for adjustment of status, and the petitions for review involved direct appeals from the denial of a continuance. In those cases, without the government doing preliminary processing, the petitioner couldn't, in removal proceedings, receive adjudication of the adjustment application. And in those instances, the Seventh Circuit said, well, it considered whether the continuance denial was an abuse of discretion and said it was. In this case, it's different. The petitioner has already received a decision on his adjustment application. It was denied due to the material support bar, and the Seventh Circuit, in a case FT versus Holder, rejected the argument that the petitioner is making, that those three cases that involved regular adjustment of status, that those dictated that the petitioner seeks to have a discretionary exemption applied after the adjustment application has been denied. It's not a similar situation. So the court declined to apply that rationale to the situation that we have here. I will also note that this court's precedent requires that in order to show that a proceeding is fundamentally unfair, that too requires a showing of prejudice. The court held that in Molina v. Holder, and it also discussed that in Aguirre v. U.S., which laid out the prejudice standard. If the court looks at pages 1017 through 1037 of the record, you'll see the immigration judge's analysis regarding adverse credibility. The judge asked for arguments on it. He then finds that the government's arguments are convincing. The only argument that petitioner had made to support the claim that he was credible was that the refugee officer had simply made assumptions about him having a weapon and guarding an area, and the immigration judge rejected that. He did later say that he could change his mind on credibility, but ultimately did not. That's at 1033 to 34. He said if he issued an oral decision today, he would make an adverse credibility finding, and he called the Department of Homeland Security's argument dead on and that he would be sustained on appeal.
What's your response to the argument that the country conditions have deteriorated since 2012?
They have not.
As for, deportees in his personal circumstances.
So there were various claims that he made regarding changed country conditions. The claims regarding the treatment of Christians recognized that there was a deterioration at one point in the treatment of Christians. But since 2017, ISIS had been, the Iraqi military had pushed ISIS out, and it didn't have any strongholds any longer. So the particularly bad treatment of Christians when ISIS was in control of various areas were no longer in effect, and the evidence showed that there's always been some level of mistreatment of Christians, so he couldn't show that there were materially changed country conditions from the time of his original hearing. The immigration judge and the board reasonably concluded that the record showed that it is people who are either Sunni or are suspected of having connections to ISIS that are targeted for torture, and the petitioner is neither of those. While he says that he's converted to Christianity, he was Shia. So that's not an issue. There's also evidence saying that people who have lived in the United States for a long time are particularly unlikely to be considered ISIS supporters. So even if there are changed country conditions, he still can't show that he has a particular likelihood of being tortured. And if the court has no further questions, I will.
And thank you, counsel. Ms. Casey, you have some rebuttal?
Thank you. Is this good volume? The issue is fundamental fairness. Mr. Alghizi was eligible for a non-discretionary form of relief. He had counsel that failed to prepare to object to critical evidence, failed to understand the applications for relief for which he was seeking, repeatedly and enthusiastically waived his right to appeal before the immigration judge had even entered a decision, failed to understand that the judge had entered an adverse credibility finding or had at least written on the as a last-minute add-on to his decision after waiving appeal. And then everything that has come after has prejudiced Mr. Alghizi. The record is soiled by the ineffective assistance of counsel by his prior attorney. And therefore, with his application to reopen proceedings, his I-485 application for adjustment of status, asserting that he is not subject to material support grounds, that is sufficient to establish prejudice here. Particularly where the asserted trig bar has to do with his participation in an uprising that is not clearly defined as terrorist activity by the immigration judge under the statute. It is not alleged that he provided material to support to any designated or non-designated terrorist group. The evidence below simply isn't sufficient to have put Mr. Alghizi on notice that he needed to do more than submit his application for adjustment of status, asserting that he was not subject to any grounds of inadmissibility, including the trig bars. For that reason, we ask that the court grant this petition for review. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel are excused. We appreciate your time and arguments this morning, and the case shall be submitted.